Well, good afternoon, brother. We've had a real wonderful feast at the Lord's table. He's put many, many nourishing things there, and we trust that this will be one more morsel provided by the Lord. It's amazing how things have dovetailed together to lead to this lesson. We didn't realize that, you know, earlier that we had the last talk of the convention, but here we are. And a lot of things have led up to this. In fact, to echo what Brother Robert said, never quit, or I think Churchill said, never give up, never give up, never give up, never give up. And that's essentially what we're going to be talking about. We're going to talk about really about 1,000 years in the history of Israel in a specific area. But really what this has to do is our responsibility as new creatures. And before we talk about that, I do want to give love from the Muhammad Ecclesia, especially from Sister Karen. I've talked to her a couple times every day, and the phone line is not really thick enough and large enough to convey all the love back and forth. But so we'll have to make up for that when we get home. We can't give the hugs over the phone. But her heart is here with all of you. So we want to talk about our responsibilities as new creatures. And really, this has to do with the goal of developing the likeness of God's dear Son in us, that the righteousness of the law may be fulfilled in us who walk not after the flesh but after the Spirit. That's really what the goal is. But if you look at this, here we have our chart. There is Adam over 6,000 years ago. We can find that this is a very, very long walk that we've been asked to take. Mankind has been walking actually in the wrong direction for over 6,000 years. From the time of Adam in Genesis 2:17, but of the tree of knowledge of good and evil thou shalt not eat, etc., etc. But we know that in Genesis 3:6, Eve took of the fruit, she ate, she gave to Adam, and he ate. And really, mankind has been eating of that fruit for the last 6,000 years. Really, the knowledge of evil than the knowledge of good. But we, brethren, have to commit ourselves to walk in the right direction. Absolutely as much as possible, right now. Even while the wrong influences are all around us, pressuring us to be like them. The world wants us to be like them, to go in their paths. We have to take a different direction. And that we got to swim upstream. We have to go against the current. Now, it'll be very, very different for the world in the future. You see, they don't have the affinity for righteousness. We have this affinity, the magnet, we're the steel that had the affinity for it. Well, they don't have that kind of affinity for righteousness, so it's going to be very different for them. In the immediate to our face of the kingdom, all the bad influences will be removed. In Isaiah 35:8, a highway shall be there, the way of holiness. No lion shall be there, no ravenous beast shall go up there. It won't be found there at all. The redeemed will walk there. Mankind will be brought to human perfection with righteous influences all around them. So if they fail, it's going to be because they didn't want to take advantage of what they were being immersed in. So there's no fault but their own. We, brethren, on the other hand, here and now, we must achieve perfection of character right now with difficult, contrary influences all around us. So God wants us to learn how to discern the right things and recognize the wrong things and know how to make the right decisions for the betterment of the new creature that we've consecrated. We have consecrated, really, to make our calling election sure, to foster and nurture our new creature until it's perfected. Our Father wants the very best for us. He wants us to understand exactly what is the very best for us. And He wants us to cultivate the desires for the good and the desire to reject the bad. He wants us to say, I don't want those things. Not to just say, oh, I can't do that. I'm not supposed to do that. He wants to say, I don't want to do that. I want the right things. You don't just set up pickets. Eventually, the pickets have to be torn down. You say, we don't need them anymore because I don't want that at all. I have desire only for the right things. And keep in mind, these are not necessarily evil things, but even good things can take up our time, our talents, our resources, and end up defocusing us from the goal. And that was good enough. You know, the adversary at one time figured, I got to kill all these saints out here. Now he says, you know what, that didn't work. 1878, wake-up call. He found out that didn't work so well. They're all back, and now they're more powerful than ever. But what if I can, I don't need to kill them. I can just deflect them from their goal. I'll get them interested in something else, and that way I defeat them, and they'll be dead. And keep in mind, the adversary wants you dead, every single one of you. Every single one of me, too. So keep in mind that Jesus consecrated himself to do not even the will of a perfect human being. He rejected his will as well. The will of a perfect human being would have been to live forever. But he consecrated his sacrifice, even that, to do God's will, which included his death. Well, Jesus had to go through many experiences which would crystallize his perfect character, but we, on the other hand, must first develop and establish that perfect character before it can be tested, crystallized, and perfected, you know, tested completely. Well, how do we do this? Well, part of the answer is in the story of the wood chips and the apples. Brother also has this story in the reprints where there's a little boy who was, he was having, you know, fighting at school and not doing his lessons and, you know, just having trouble all around. And his dad was talking to him and the little boy said, well, you know, I just have trouble with so many things. And he was using his time doing all this stuff that was really not good for him. And his dad said, well, let's see, I got a lesson for you. Go out, take this basket, go out to the wood pile and fill it up with wood chips. So the little boy did. He says, no, I want you to fill that same basket with apples. And the little boy says, well, I can't do that. He said, well, why not? He says, because it's filled with wood chips. And his father said, that's the whole point. Dump out the chips, and then you can fill it with apples. You got to recognize the wrong stuff, get rid of it. Now you can put the right stuff in. Well, what we'd like to do now is take a look at the influences in our lives and how they can affect us and change us. Because I think anybody of any maturity realizes that you will be changed by the influences under which you place yourself. Years go by, you become a different person. But at the beginning, you get to choose the influences you place yourself under. So you choose the right influences. If you choose the wrong influences, you'll be degraded and you'll become somebody you really don't want to be. Now, when we take at the nation of Israel, when they came out of Egypt, God realized they'd been degraded by the Egyptians and he had to bring them out, give them a law, and the law was going to be really the schoolmaster to bring them to a wonderful opportunity. But you know, this is going to be a really tough lesson. But he was very specific in his dealings with Israel on how he views the wrong influences in the lives of his people. God absolutely abhors the wrong influences affecting his children. Are there any parents here? What do you think of when you see a terrible influence affecting your child? That's how God feels. He wants us to view things from his standpoint and develop his ability, his same ability to recognize the wrong influences and totally eliminate them from our lives as much as possible. Because we are on a life and death mission, and we all know this, we can take no prisoners, we can harbor no enemies, and we must be successful. But what if we find that we have failed along these lines? What if after weeks or months or years or even decades, we found out we have allowed something to enter into our lives, take up our time and resources, it's been a bad influence on us? We finally come to our senses. What do? Is all lost? Do we give up? Do we stop and declare defeat? You know, do we grab the anchor and jump overboard with it? Can anything be done? Well, our loving, merciful, and just Heavenly Father has laid this out for us, and this is our lesson today. Israel, they came out of Egypt. They were degraded. God says, okay, you are my people, but you've got a lot of work to do if you're going to get to the point and develop the way you should. So God immediately brings them to Mount Sinai. You know, the first year they're in Mount Sinai, and it reminds me of high school kids when they go off to college. You know, the first couple of weeks they're like wild Indians whooping it up. You know, we're away from mom and dad. And I'm sure there was a sort of a tendency like that when they get out from under the taskmasters. And so God's going to give them the law, give them these standards as soon as possible. Here's the first law, Exodus 20, verse 3. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Very first one. Followed by the second one, thou shalt not make any graven images or likeness of anything. Thou shalt not bow down to them, for I, the Lord, am a jealous God. And they said in Exodus 24, all that the Lord has said, we will do and be obedient. You know, they went through all these commandments, more than just the first 10. But I, the Lord, the God, am a jealous God. Not because he has jealous in an egotistical way, because this is really a zealous God. He says, I'm zealous for your good. God doesn't need anything for himself. Everything he does is to bless others. Absolutely everything. What he wants is the very best for Israel. And he realizes there's nothing that is anything other than him and his influence is going to be bad. That's why he's zealous for Israel. That's what he's telling them. But immediately what happens after Exodus 24, Moses goes up into the mount. You get down to Exodus 30. He's up there receiving more features of the law and ceremonial law, etc. They don't know where he's gone. They lose faith. Exodus 32, what do? I mean, right out of the box, right after they've gotten the law and they said, yes, all these things will we do and be obedient, they emphasize it. They say to Aaron, make us gods. Exodus 32, 1 through 4. Aaron, make us gods. We don't know what happened to this Moses. So Aaron says, okay, well, break off your golden earring. And note, that's the only gold that was used for the golden calf. If you're going to give something else the veneration that's due God, very simple, break off your golden earring, and that's what you make the golden calf out of. Because you don't need it to listen to what God's telling you anymore. Because you've just told him you don't want to hear it. Interesting little side note there. So they made the golden calf and they said, these be thy gods, O Israel, that brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. Well, it's apparent, even though God gave them this law and they gave the lip service to say, yes, we're going to do it, that they didn't get it. They didn't get the importance of this first commandment. How can you possibly learn righteousness when you're setting up other gods? Any other god is an abomination, and any influence that detracts from the veneration of the one true God can only hurt them. It cannot possibly help them. So it had nothing to do with God's ego. It had to do with the good for Israel. That's why God was so zealous about this. And I think teachers know this. You know, I don't know how many have done teaching. How many have done teaching? You know, and it doesn't matter, kindergarten, you name it. It's hard enough to teach kids. You know, I teach in a college. But it's hard, and Facebook is the killer of the future generation, by the way. But it's hard enough to teach kids when you have their undivided attention. If you don't even have their attention, it's a completely lost cause. Forget it. It's never going to happen. That's why God is telling them this. Pay attention. If you don't, I mean, you might as well just go off and be a heathen, because that's the direction you're going. Well, the result we know. Moses comes down the mount. The tables are broken. Who was on the Lord's side? The sons of Levi gathered themselves, and they slay 3,000 of Israel, 3,000 men. Now, when you read the Bible, you say, oh, yeah, 3,000 were killed. Oh, ho-hum, all right. A small number compared to others. How many were killed when the trade towers came down? 3,000. That's now initiated the largest, longest war, so-called, in the history of this country, with more expense. If you were to pile up 3,000 dead bodies in this room, I think they'd go up to the ceiling. I mean, this is a horrific thing to get Israel's attention. That's what it was for, to get their attention. Wake up. God's saying, I am serious about this. To try to get get them to listen. God was showing them there's no greater sin in Israel than breaking the first commandment. But Israel was still thinking like Egyptians. It would take many hard lessons like this for them to learn this lesson, to trust God, to know where the source of righteousness was. Well, God wanted them to learn righteousness, and they had to give him their undivided attention. Well, in Exodus 23, verses 31 through 33, he tells them, he says, I will deliver the inhabitants of the land into your hand. This is the idea they're going to go into the land of Canaan. This is before Kadesh Barnea. So he's preparing them. You'll drive them out before you. You'll make no covenant with them, nor their gods. They'll not dwell on your land, lest they make you sin against me. For if you serve their gods, it will certainly be a snare unto you. We talked about snares. In Exodus 34, verse 16, don't let your daughters marry their daughters marry your sons, because your daughters will go whoring after their gods and make your sons go whoring after them. And it's a lost cause again. That's what God was saying. Well, later, as Israel fails the big test at Kadesh Barnea, the spies, the evil report, their refusal to go into the land, and they now continue in the wilderness for 39 years, because God is waiting for the adults to die off, so that the younger generation, who he's going to school as much as possible, they'll be ready to go in the land. And unfortunately, this is how some lessons have to be learned. The adults can't learn it, you got to wait for them to die. And hopefully the younger generation, you can deal with them. That's happened in many, many different cases other than just the scriptures. Throughout history. Well, during this time, King Balak, he sees these hordes of Israel going through his land. He's very afraid. He goes to this pagan prophet, Balaam, and says, Balaam, I want you to curse Israel. You know, curse them for me. But Balaam can only repeat the blessings which God has for Israel. So Balaam gets very upset. You know, I'm trying to pay you to curse him and look at what's happening. Well, Balaam really wanted the reward. So what he says essentially, we can't separate God from Israel, but if we can separate Israel from God, then you've got it. So the idea was to make Israel go lusting after the Moabite women. They'd be led away to the Moabite gods, and then God would be happy to destroy them. Problem solved. In Numbers 25, 1 through 9, we'll just skip through this. So they abode in Shittim. There was a whoredom with the daughters of Moab. They started giving sacrifice to the Moabite gods. They bowed down to their altars. Now in Numbers 25:3 is very important. Because God at this point, he's trying to deal with Israel as their one entity. And we want to see this. Israel really has one entity, like they're one man. Because we're going to pick this up when they cross Jordan. But in Numbers 25:3 it says, and Israel joined himself unto Baal Peor. And the Lord said to Moses, okay, take the heads and the princes of the people who were sinning this way. Kill them, hang them up before the Lord. Slay every one of the men that were joined to Baal Peor. And, one of the children of Israel, he comes in with a Midianitish woman, and Phinehas, who is the son of Eleazar, he rises up, takes a javelin, thrusts it through both of them, both the man and the Midianitish woman. And when all was said and done, 24,000 of Israel were killed. 24,000. Israel had to pay a terrible personal cost to learn this lesson. Phinehas took immediate action and stayed God's wrath. But note, at this point in Israel's development, the largest action was done by God himself in killing Israel with this plague. So they hadn't learned it themselves. They hadn't learned personal responsibility yet. God was still doing this, punishing them, trying to get them to wake up, because they were allowing them to themselves to go under these terrible influences. Well, years later, Moses gives his final message when they're about to. Moses is right before his death. And in Deuteronomy 7, he mentions 7 verse 1 through 4. It says, "When the Lord thy God shall bring thee into the land," talking about the people in the land, he says, "Thou shalt smite them, thou shalt kill them, utterly destroy them, make no covenant, show no mercy, neither shall you make any marriages, for they will turn away thy sons from following me." Same thing, repeating this again. Well, as they go into the land, Aaron and Moses are dead, along with Eleazar, this leaving Joshua in charge with Phinehas as the third high priest. We want to keep that in mind. Phinehas is the third high priest now. All the guilty adults that had rebelled at Kadesh Barnea, they're now dead. This was at Gilgal. In fact, the name Gilgal means to roll away. God had rolled away the sin, which makes sense because all those who committed it were now dead. So they're going to be going into, they're going to cross Jordan under Joshua, and who would lead them into Canaan, this land flowing with milk and honey. Now here's the picture. Israel under Joshua, and God had already said, Israel joined himself. He's dealing with Israel as like it's one person. Well, Israel going into the promised land under Joshua as their head, their leader, is really a picture of one new creature entering into his own character with the Lord as his head, looking for all the enemies and slaying them utterly. That's the job. That's the whole idea. You find a character enemy in yourself, slay it utterly. Take no prisoners. Destroy it. That's really the whole picture. We can't do it ourselves, but with the Lord as our head, we can. We can. Well, Israel crosses Jordan. They're circumcised. They partake of the Passover. Really, God is showing once again, Israel as a nation is picturing this spiritual class. These are all really emblems of spirit begettal. Then they go and they take Jericho. Wonderful victory. We're all familiar with that. Then they go on to Ai. But unfortunately, they had lost God's favor because of a sin. They go to Ai and they fail. In fact, they get routed. Ai chases them like they're little children. And Israel has a terrible failure. So Joshua, in Joshua 7:11, God says, "Israel hath sinned, and they've also transgressed my covenant, which I commanded them." Now notice he says, Israel has sinned, but it was just one man. But God says, Israel, I look at you as a unit. You have sinned. You've taken this accursed thing. But Israel was counted as having the sin, not simply by the one who committed this act, but the sin was on Israel as a whole, because God was viewing them as this single unit, just like each one of us, as a new creature. Where there's some very bad tendency or desire in us that acts in some way, we got to get rid of it. We got to put that to death. That's what's really being pictured here. So they drew lots. Now notice who's doing it. God didn't say, you do this. They're the ones who decided to do that. They drew lots. They found Achan. They talked to him. And he says, yeah, I coveted the spoils. I did it. So they say, okay, I'm glad you're honest about it. Here's the punishment. And what they took him. They took Achan, the silver, the gold, the garments, his sons, his daughters, his oxen, asses, sheep, tent, and all that they had, stoned it and burned it. Total, absolute destruction. But note, Israel wasn't destroyed, just Achan, who pictured this selfish tendency in the flesh. That had to be destroyed, utterly, totally, without mercy. But the thing that's good about this is they were learning personal responsibility for maintaining their relationship with God. They realize we've got to do it. You know, God can't do it all, or else they're not learning anything. They've got to do it themselves. Just as we as new creatures, we have to take the personal responsibility to search our own character, find the problems, root them out, and utterly destroy them. Because this is a battle we must fight and we must win. We don't do this, we will be failures. Well, later Israel took Ai, but they went in with a greater force, better planning, and greater care, and they were victorious. Well, this total destruction that we'll find in Ai, it's in harmony with Deuteronomy 20, 16, and 17. That's Deuteronomy 20, 16, and 17, which Moses had told them before they crossed Jordan. And he said, "But of the cities of these people, which the Lord thy God doth give thee for an inheritance, thou shalt save nothing alive that breatheth." Save nothing that breathes. That's a pretty powerful statement. Thou shalt utterly destroy them, namely, and he names them, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites. Now we want to keep in mind the Hivites here. We're going to come back to the Hivites. The Jebusites, as the Lord thy God had commanded thee. Because that's this picture. I mean, this is not some merciless God here doing this out of vengeance. This is a picture for his church, for the body of Christ, you know, that wouldn't even be around for, you know, thousands of years. Well, if we look at ourselves, things aren't always this simple for us as new creatures. Our flesh is devious and we'll do anything to survive. Jeremiah 17, verses 9 and 10. The heart of the natural man, the fallen man, is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? I, the Lord, search the heart. Notice, you can do your part, but God is going to show you where you're messing up. He's going to show you failures. In fact, in a testimony, I didn't want to take much time, but in some of the failures that I was relating, I really appreciated that. Because I don't know where all the problems are, but my Heavenly Father does. So he says, I'll give you the experience. I'll show you the ugly stuff that's in there. It'll come out, and then you know what you have to work on. So our failures are real. We learn, I think, more from our failures than we do from our successes. So when you fail, say, thank you. I needed that. I need to see that. So who can know it? Our Heavenly Father does. Well, in the Foes and Besetments chapter in 6th volume, page 601, I just want to read this brief excerpt. The old heart, the old affections, the selfish disposition frequently practice deceptions upon the new heart and say in effect, now you've reckoned me dead, you've put me out, and I am dead as respect what I was, and I'm not the same old heart I was formerly, but you must give me some consideration. How many times how many have found themselves brought into bondage by the deceitfulness of the old heart. If the old heart, the old mind, the old will can get the new one to make a compromise of truth or duty for the sake of peace, there will be no end to the demands it will make. And the result will be that the new creature would soon, in the interest of peace, be violating the very essence of his covenant with the Lord and be fully submitting himself to the old will. Starts with something little, grows, grows, grows. Pretty soon, no more sacrificing. Well, let's look at the Gibeonites, because this is right after Ai, right after Ai was taken. Gibeon was a town not far from Ai. It was actually one of the next ones that Israel should have gone and destroyed utterly. It was one of five cities of the Hivites. One of five cities of the Hivites. In Joshua 9:3, it says, the inhabitants of Gibeon, these are Hivites, they heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and Ai. And we'll paraphrase here. What they did is they said, what can we do here? Oh, well, let's put on old clothes, old shoes. We'll put moldy bread in bags. We'll come around a different direction, and we'll come into the camp of Israel, and we'll say, boy, we've come from a long way away. And we've heard what happened. We know that your God is the one true God, and we don't want any trouble. You know, we think he's the one true God, too. So we'd like to make a covenant with you. We'd like to make a league with you. So before checking with God, Joshua did. Joshua 9:15, Joshua made peace with them, made a league with them, and let them live. Well, 3 days later, Joshua finds out, my word, you're the next city over. We were supposed to destroy everything that breathes there, but I'll be good to my word. So he made them servants, hewers of wood, carriers of water. But note what happened here. These Hivites, these pagans in the land, these Gibeonites, would not be separated from Israel as God wanted. Very quickly, they would become a terrible influence on Israel and cause one of the greatest disasters in Israel's history. Israel made a league with the Hivites contrary to God's ordinance, and there would be a reckoning. Well, we're going to go forward some years to Judges 19 through 21. Judges 19 through 21, this is sort of an obscure but very powerful series of events. And actually, these chapters seem to be put in as an appendix to Judges, but it really should be near the beginning of the chapter. I think it was put at the end because it's such a horrific set of events that they sort of pushed it. They kept it in the book, but they pushed it to the end. The reason for that is if you look at Phinehas. Phinehas is one of the players in this, and he was the high priest when they first entered the land. And if they were chronologically really came at the end of Judges, Phinehas would have had to be several hundred years old. It seems a clear proof it happened much, much, much sooner, which is a good lesson to see how quickly a bad influence can work. Well, we'd like to go through Judges 19 through, through 21, but we'll be skipping through things. But this is a good thing to read. Well, it came to pass that there was this Levite who was sojourning in Mount Ephraim. He had a concubine or a wife, and she was upset. She left him. She went home to mother, mom and dad. So what he did is after a little while, he said, well, I want to make up with my wife. He goes back and goes to where she lives, goes to the father's house, makes peace, brings his wife. And after a couple of days, they decide they're going to go back to where he was from. Well, they're going to be passing through the area of the Benjamites, and he decides, well, let's stay in Gibeah. Well, Gibeah was not Gibeon, but is another city of the Hivites that were allowed to live. So they go into town. Well, there's another man who is also from Mount Ephraim. He sees these strangers, and he says, no, you believe me, you can't camp in the middle of a square here. That's not going to work. Come into my house. So he entertains them. So the Levite and his concubine, well, in the middle of the night, on the front door, it's the Benjamites, and they say, bring that man out that we may know him. What does that sound like? It's exactly what the Sodomites did. So their host says, oh, my brethren, don't be so wicked. Here, take my daughter, take his wife, his concubine. So they do. They rape them all night. In the morning, they're dead on the doorstep. The Levite gets up, takes his wife, puts her on his ass, goes out of town, chops her into 12 pieces, sends the pieces all over Israel to muster the troops. What happens is now 400,000 of Israel are going to come because this is a terrible, terrible, heinous sin in Israel. In Judges 20, verse 1, note the phrasing here. Then all the children of Israel went out, and the congregation was gathered as one man. As one man. Verse 8, and all the people arose as one man, saying, we will not any of us go to his tent, neither will any of us turn to his house. But now this shall be the thing which we will do to Gibeah. We will go up by lot against it. In other words, they're making the decision. They don't know who's going to go up first, but by tribe. In other words, they're going to go up tribe by tribe. So note, they decided themselves to purge this great sin from Israel. God didn't tell them what to do. They're doing it. So in Judges 20, verse 12, they sent men through all the tribe of Benjamin, saying, give us these men. Deliver these men who did this terrible sin, and we're going to put them to death. But then they say, we will put them to death to put away this evil from Israel. In other words, they didn't say from Benjamin, it's your sin. They said, this is a sin in Israel. You're defiling all of us. So Israel, again, was seen as a single unit. Well, in Judges 20:14, the children of Benjamin refused, and they decided that they were going to go in battle against the children of Israel. So, here's what happens. We have 26,000 men of Benjamin that drew sword. And 700 of them, notice Benjamin is picturing this defilement of the flesh, this selfish tendency. And note how powerful it is. They had 700 men who could sling stones at a hair's breadth and not miss. In other words, you try to go up against this enemy, you will die. there will be blood. Israel knows this. Well, in Judges 20:17, the men of Israel beside Benjamin were 400,000. In verse 18, they went up and asked counsel of God, what should we do? You know, we're going to go to this battle, and God says, I endorse that. Judah will be the first to go up. You're all going to go up, but Judah is going to lead the battle. So the children of Israel went out. They had their battle. 22,000 men of Israel were killed. No mention of any casualties of Benjamin. 22,000 of Israel are now killed. At the end of the day, they go back up to the house of God. They're weeping. They've lost their sons, their fathers, their brothers, fighting against Benjamin. No mention of any casualties on Benjamin's part. And they're asking God, what should we do? Look at what we've lost. And God said, you go up again. So they went up the next day. They lost 18,000 more men with no mention of any casualties of Benjamin. And went back again weeping, more sons and fathers and brothers slain. What, God, what should we do? God said, you go up again. But this time, I can see your resolve. I know you're willing to pay any price necessary to rid Israel of this sin. I'm going to give Benjamin into your hand. So they went up again. They changed their tactics. They drew the men of Benjamin out of the cities. They destroyed the cities, razed them to the ground. They killed 26,000 men of Benjamin. There were only 600 left alive. And finally they say, wait, Benjamin's our brother. We've now killed 99% of all that breathes in the tribe of Benjamin. So they stopped. And they offered burnt offerings, I think not for the killing that they had done, but for Benjamin, on Benjamin's behalf. The cost of this sin was 99% of the tribe of Benjamin and 40,000, or 10% of all the armies of Israel. This was a terrible price to pay to purge this sin. But remember, Israel decided to purge the sin and God endorsed it. And after they proved, by losing 40,000 of their men and coming back for more, God says, I know, I see your resolve. God gave them the victory. This is why Benjamin became the smallest tribe. Well, Israel was willing to destroy part of itself to eliminate this terrible pagan influence, just as we must be willing to do the same in ourselves. If we have become prey to a deceptive fallen influence, whether it's good or outwardly bad, and we find that it's had this effect on us, we've made a deal with this influence, then we must eventually act. We might have to pay a very high price to return to God's favor, but it can be done and it must be done to the extent of our ability. In Matthew 5, verse 30, if thy right hand offend thee, cut it off. If thy eye offend thee, pluck it out. Better these things should perish than your whole body should be cast into Gehenna, a picture of second death. Well, the last example we'd like to talk about is after the decree of Cyrus, Zerubbabel had led about 52,000 of Israel back to Jerusalem. And they began to rebuild the temple. The foundation was laid. But what had happened is some other folks in the land, they came and they wanted help, say, let us help you build. And they said, no, you can't do that, because if you start building the temple, you're going to want us to tell us what gods to worship. So you can have nothing to do with that. So they got upset. They sent letters to the king. They had the work stop. This work stopped for over 20 years. Well, later Zerubbabel resumes the work, but the zeal of the people was not as great. And in the 20 years of idleness, there are some things they did that weren't so good. Finally, in Ezra chapter 9, Ezra 9:1, Ezra the priest now comes to Jerusalem. And what does he find? Well, in Ezra 9:1, the people of Israel and the priests and the Levites have not separated themselves from the people of the land, doing according to their abominations. Even the Canaanites, Hittites, Perizzites, Jebusites, Ammonites, Moabites, etc. It says, for they have taken their daughters for themselves and their sons. Now, how many times did God just told them, never, ever, ever, ever do this? And not just the common people, but the princes, the rulers, they have been the chief in this trespass. So in Ezra 9:6, Ezra said, he's praying to God. He says, oh my God, I'm ashamed and blush to lift my face. He says, I can't even raise my face to God. Our iniquities are increased over our head. Our trespass has grown up unto the heavens. In Ezra 9:15, he says, O Lord God, Israel, thou art righteous, for we remain yet escaped. In other words, we were in Babylon for 70 years. You've let us come back in your mercy, in your love. I mean, you've exacted the justice, and in your mercy, you've let us come back. And look at what we've done. He says, we cannot stand before thee because of this. Well, Ezra was just prostrate on the ground. I mean, he was crying to the Lord audibly, and a crowd is gathering around him. In Ezra 10, verse 1, there assembled unto him out of Israel a very great congregation of men and women and children, for the people wept very sore. Because they're starting to realize, from what Ezra has been saying in his prayer, they've realized what they've done. They've realized how wrong that is. And then Shechaniah in verse 2, Ezra 10, verse 2. And Shechaniah, his name means God dwells. God dwells. Shechaniah was the son of Jehiel, which means God lives. So here's the voice of wisdom, really, really what God would have them do. Shechaniah answered and said to Israel, we have trespassed against our God and have taken strange wives of the people of the land. And then he says, yet now there is hope in Israel concerning this thing. Now therefore let us make a covenant with our God to put away all the wives and their children. To think of that, to say we'll put away these pagan wives and the children, here's a tremendous cost. How many of you would be willing to put away your spouse and your children who you've reared, you've lived with, you've loved? Here's a tremendous cost. In Ezra 10:10, Ezra stands up and he said, ye have transgressed, ye have taken strange wives. 11th verse, now therefore make confession unto the Lord, God of your fathers, and do his pleasure, and separate yourselves from the people of the land and from the strange wives. And all the congregation answered and said, as thou hast said, so must we do. The steps they took, they remembered God's commandment. They admitted their guilt and they vowed to undo the damage that they had been done at a great personal cost. Their wives, their children would now be put away. Not killed, but sent away. I'm sure they were still supporting them. I mean, they still had those responsibilities. But a terrible cost. Once they realized what had been done wrong, just as we also must purge ourselves from any influence that detracts from our relationship with God, whether it was a good or bad, whether it's outwardly good or bad. And keep in mind, influences are invisible things. They can be hard to recognize or to admit. They flow into us. That's the whole idea of influence. And they change us. Now, we may think we won't be affected. Well, I had a wonderful experience last summer with just exactly this. Something invisible. It was a nice spring day. We have arborvitae in our backyard, and a nice row of arborvitae. But in the corner, there was a big cedar bush, which had been overgrown by the arborvitae. and it's about 15 feet tall, and it had died. So, well, it died a couple of years ago, but, you know, the maintenance man at my house, he's slow. Anyway, it was such a nice day. I went out there. I said, Sister Karen, I'm going to go take this out. So she comes out and helps me, and I got a ladder, and I'm clipping and pulling big branches, and I'm now up the ladder, and I'm clipping and pulling and all this stuff, and pretty soon my feet are about 5 or 6 off the ground, feet off the ground, and I'm clipping and pulling, and all of a sudden I'm looking around, and there are all these bushy leaves all around me. Bushy leaves, this is like a cedar bush, and it's arborvitae. There shouldn't be any leaves. What's this? And I look closer. Oh, it's poison ivy. How about that? But I thought, well, that's no problem, because I'm immune. I've always been immune to poison ivy. But I said, sweetie, stop. Go wash everything off, you know, get some rubbing alcohol, wash it, you know, get some gloves, long sleeve, because, you know, she's just a weak female. But I, you know, tough guy. Well, but, you know, I'm immune. Well, the next day, you know, we got the job all done, feeling pretty good, but itch. The day after that, itch. Well, within a week, I looked like I had been whipped. I mean, I had welts, purple welts. I had to be on steroids, and I spent 3 weeks pretty much moaning on the couch. It was a good 2-3 months until the effects were away. But I thought, it was later this summer when this became apparent to me, the lesson we're talking about. But I thought, what a great lesson. I was immune to this invisible influence. It can't hurt me. Well, later I found out, after I had immersed myself in it, oh yeah, it can hurt you. In fact, you get enough of it, it'll kill you. So, brethren, let's err on the safe side and not be presumptuous or even tempt God, thinking that we are immune to new creature poison. Paul says, if we would judge ourselves, we should not be judged. Well, we have to judge ourselves, scrutinize ourselves, and say, what are we doing? What are we doing in our lives? Is this for the new creature? Is this gratifying the flesh? Make the decision. Something that Debbie McGruff said to me, I really appreciate it, where he said something to this effect. God gives us this wonderful, wonderful opportunity to prove our love and dedication to Him. He gives us an impossible task, and then He watches to see just how hard we try to accomplish it. That's our situation. To do fully what we really would want to do in our heart of hearts, it's impossible. But God just wants to see, how hard are you going to try? How much of the time are you going to dedicate? Paul said to Timothy in 2 Timothy 2:20 and 21, in a great house there are not only vessels of gold, silver, but there are also of wood, earth, some to honor and some to dishonor. If a man therefore purge himself from these, he shall be a vessel unto honor. We have to do the purging. Malachi 3:3, he shall sit as a refiner and purifier of silver, and he'll purify the sons of Levi and purge them as gold and silver, that they may offer unto the Lord an offering of righteousness. Well, the purging is a lifelong task. Really, the offering is at the end. That's when we're going to be of full use to the Heavenly Father. Psalm 34:18. The Lord is nigh unto them that are of a broken heart, and save such as are of a contrite spirit. So we can look at our failures and our weaknesses and be very sorry and contrite. But if it's sincere, the contrition must lead to action. It must lead to action. Psalm 139:23. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts. See if there be any wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. But when He leads, then we must follow. We must follow. When we do this, as far as the east is from the west, so far will He remove our transgressions from us. He wants us to realize our errors, wants us to take the right steps, claim the blood of Christ to cleanse our robes. But we must be the ones to remove ourselves from any bad influences that would motivate more transgressions. And we know how to do that, and we know what they are. Every parent knows this. So we mentioned this earlier. Every parent, what influences do you want your children to be under? The best ones. You see a bad influence for your kids, I mean, you're going to rip them out of there. Try to do it lovingly so they don't hate you, or they're going to, because kids can get confused. But you want what's absolutely best. Well, we are tending our embryo new creature, which is growing and developing in the womb of the seraphic feature of the Abrahamic covenant. God is giving it the best. We have to give it the best. We don't want to be charged with child abuse. You didn't take care of that embryo new creature. Well, we must. We have to. The September 14th manna, with us is the Lord our God to help us and to fight our battles. That was 2 Chronicles 32:8. How many have found that the breaking of earthly ties has meant the strengthening of the heavenly ones? That the opposition of the world and the adversary has meant increase of spiritual favor, because greater is he that is for us than all they that be against us. So, brethren, if we have failed along these lines, and I have, in some big ways, but if we have failed along these lines, let us not lose heart, because we can never give up. Never give up. In Proverbs 24:16, for a just man falleth 7 times, but that's not the important part. The important part is he rises up again. So as Shechaniah said 2,400 years ago, brethren, yet now there is hope in Israel. And may the Lord add his blessing.